It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll give you some ideas for what to listen to when you need a break from jingle bells.
First, according to new research out this week, lakes across the globe are warming, and they're doing it at a rate that's faster than ocean and air temperatures. And that's raising some serious questions about the future of the world's lakes and the humans and animals that rely on them.
The research also found that lakes in northern climates seem to be warming faster, Lake Superior being one that's of particular interest to Wisconsin residents. So what could a warmer Lake Superior mean for us, and is this warming trend reversible?
Jay Austin is with us now. He's a professor at the University of Minnesota Duluth Large Lakes Observatory, and he's co-author of the new study on rising lake temperatures. Jay, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Veronica. Thanks for having me on.
So from what you found, how quickly are lakes across the world warming?
There's a wide range of warming rates. And let me say to start that I'm one of 60 authors on this paper. So this is a big collaborative effort. And the idea here is that lots of us in the lake community or lake research community have been publishing papers for a while now looking at the fact that individual lakes are warming at different rates. This was the first time where lots of us got together and brought data on over 200 lakes to look at not just rates of warming, but what sort of things lakes had in common with each other and what sort of characteristics of lakes made them more or less prone to warming. So we had anything from lakes that aren't really significantly warming, even lakes that are cooling a tiny bit, very, very few of those, to lakes that are warming up to a degree Celsius per decade or about 2 degrees Fahrenheit per decade.
And it turns out that lakes are a pretty good bellwether for climate change. How come?
Because lakes, so most of what we know about climate change, or a great deal of what we know about climate change from the instrumental record, we know from air temperature measurements. Air temperature varies rapidly. As a weather system blows through, as we're all well aware, the temperature can increase or decrease by many degrees Celsius. Lakes, because they're made of water in some sense, are sort of a low-pass filter or have a smoothing effect on that, and so they change much more slowly and end up being a very robust measurement of what the climate is like at a particular location on the landscape.
So you said there are some lakes that are not warming very quickly or just a very few that are cooling, but in general, you're seeing warming here. And what is driving that warming?
Well, the warming is consistent. What we're seeing is consistent with the idea that global air temperatures have been increasing over the last century or so. And you've presumably been keeping up with the goings-on in Paris over the last few weeks. The consensus among scientists who study this stuff is that increases in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are leading to increased air temperatures, and those in turn are leading to this increase, this slow but steady increase we're seeing in lake water temperatures.
Now, a lot of people get concerned when we talk about changes to the oceans, when we hear about acidification and rising temperatures, because we know these are huge bodies of water that affect the climate of the world, really.
Sure.
Why should we worry about lakes? They're not as large as the oceans. Why do we need to be concerned?
Well, we can think about this two ways. One is we can say that lakes, the fact that we've been able to document these warming trends in hundreds of lakes around the world is another piece of evidence that this warming really is going on. Okay, so these are data sets that have been collected independently by dozens and dozens of scientists over many, many years, but they all tell us roughly the same thing. Why we should be concerned about it is that temperature, to a large extent, is one of the sort of driving variables for ecosystems within these lakes. So if you talk to a biologist or an ecologist about how these lakes work, all of these linkages between various elements of an ecosystem are always going to be heavily dependent on temperature. So nutrient uptake rates or metabolisms or even the range of temperatures that fish are comfortable at or that they want to spawn at are all really strong functions of temperature.
We're talking to Jay Austin right now from the University of Minnesota, talking about a new study looking at rising lake temperatures across the world and why Lake Superior is warming faster than other lakes. Now, when we talk about rising temperatures, what sort of temperature change are we talking about here?
We're talking about a couple degrees Celsius over the course of many decades. So again, there's an enormous amount of interannual variability from year to year, and we've seen that especially over the last few years here in the upper Midwest. 2014, the year of the polar vortex, a tremendously cold year, just off the charts as far as cold. But also 2012, which was the warmest year that we've seen with regards to lake temperatures since we've been keeping records. So the total amount of variability in summer water temperatures is on the order of maybe 15 or 20 degrees Fahrenheit. It's quite large.
Now, what about
let me back up and say that's the difference between the maximum and minimum temperatures we've seen over the last maybe 30 years. Over the last 30 years, average summer water temperatures in Lake Superior are somewhere between 4 and 5 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than they were 30 years ago.
4 or 5. Now, that's getting you. If you talk about a degree or two, you think, well, it's a degree or two. It seems kind of negligible, maybe not to a scientist. But if you're sticking a toe into the water, you may not notice. But 4 or 5 degrees, you do start to notice. How significant is that?
Let me give you an example. I have a graduate student here working on his PhD. He recently put together a bunch of data on ice cover and winter air temperatures. And the difference between a year where we have lots of ice on the lake, where we have, you know, an impact on the shipping season, and we have lots of ice fishing here in Duluth, and people are recreating on the ice, and a year with basically no open lake ice, which, for instance, like 2012, the difference between a year with loads and loads of ice and a year with very little ice can be due to a difference in air temperature of as little as 1 to 2 degrees Celsius, or about 3 or 4 degrees Fahrenheit. So these small differences that they were, as you said, they sound small, but they can have, these systems can be very, very sensitive to even these small changes in air and water temperature.
Now, Lake Superior is notorious or celebrated, depending on your point of view, for being an especially cold, clear northern lake.
Yes.
What does that temperature have to do with the character of Lake Superior and its health?
Well, I think that, I mean, part of what really defines the culture, if you want to put it that way, around Lake Superior is that it is partially ice-covered in the winter. And so that's part of what makes Lake Superior Lake Superior and what makes Duluth Duluth and the rest of the Northland, for that matter. And so, again, we're talking about a very specific lake here and ice specifically, but it is part of what gives the lake its character. I think one of the interests, I'm going to go back to ice for a second here, one of the really interesting results out of this study, one nice thing about the study, of course, is that we're not concentrating on one particular lake. We're looking at 235 lakes, I think, in this study, and we can look for commonalities. And one of the most interesting trends that we were able to extract out of this large set of data was that lakes that typically form ice in the winter have significantly higher rates of warming than lakes that don't. And so lakes that are warm or are in warm or tropical climates are warming slower than lakes that typically have ice on them in the winter.
Why would that be?
Well, we've done some work here at Duluth several years ago, myself and a colleague of mine named Steve Coleman, who's recently retired, looking at the linkages between ice formation in the winter and the resulting summer water temperatures in the subsequent summer. And that ice cover, in some sense, acts as a cap. It reflects sunlight away that would normally go into warming up the water, so that when suddenly you take that ice away in the winter, when we have milder winters and we don't have as much ice, the lake is able to absorb a lot more sunlight in the late winter and early spring. And it turns out that those actually lead to significantly warmer summers. I'm not saying that that's the mechanism that's responsible for all of these ice-covered lakes, but it is one potential mechanism that I think we're going to be exploring now on a much more broad basis.
Well, one question here, can we turn this around, change these temperatures and try to normalize them such as it is?
I think that's what people were trying to do in Paris over the last couple of weeks. So that's a hard question, and I don't do policy or anything like that, and so it's difficult for me to have a really informed opinion on that. But yeah, I mean, this is part of the challenge that we face right now.
As you said, you're not a policymaker; you're a scientist. But is there a message as a scientist that you'd like to get out to the people who do make decisions about climate change policy?
that these systems are sensitive even to very small changes in temperature. And just because, like you said, you know, 2 degrees Fahrenheit or 5 degrees Fahrenheit doesn't sound like a whole lot, when we consider how complex these systems are, and often how fundamentally dependent they are on temperature, even those small changes are worth paying attention to.
Jay, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Veronica.
That was Jay Austin, professor at the University of Minnesota Duluth Large Lakes Observatory. He joined us to talk about rising lake temperatures across the world and why Lake Superior is warming faster than others. First, as the malls are piping out the holiday music we've heard probably hundreds of times before, our next guest has some fresh tracks to add to the festive season with music from around the world that we may never have heard before.
Dr. Jonathan Overby joins us now. He's the executive producer and host of the WPR Weekend World Music Show, Higher Ground. Welcome back.
Well, thank you. This is Central Time. Well, this is fun being in here with you guys.
It's been too long. Actually.
Yes, it has. Yes. Well, if you ever need a fill-in. No, I'm never available. I'm sorry. So we're here to talk about world music?
Yeah. You've got some great tracks for us. But before we get to that, when you're thinking of a festive occasion, maybe holidays, maybe other times of the year, are there particular places you go, because you've got music from all over the world, places you go or styles of music that you turn to when you want a break from maybe the obvious stuff we might play?
Well, Rob, you're setting me up here. Most Saturday nights I'm in the studio, so I don't get to go many places other than when I'm traveling around the world. But I do like to listen to a variety of kinds of music at home and in my study, and that is part of just who I am. You know, I'll have a favorite song of the week, a favorite song of the day, and after that kind of wears out, I'll go on to another style. But right now, just to share with you and Veronica, I am into Bollywood music. That's my sort of latest interest.
Well, I love Bollywood music.
Do you?
But I don't know a lot about it.
I'd love
to learn more. So I'm thinking I smell another interview. Shares having you stop by later.
Well, I am going to Mumbai next year, so I'll come back with some goodies for you.
Oh, fantastic.
That sounds great. Yeah, that'll be a lot of fun to talk to you after that.
Well, you brought along some music for us this time, and some people may love the holiday music, enjoy hearing it. You can hear it hundreds of times. Some other people might need to take a little break, back out for a while. Here's
<That's>
no
me.
One like Rob Ferret, for instance, and try something new. And you've got a few, actually, great examples here. Tell us about the first thing you brought along.
Well, I brought along some music, not as a counterpoint to holiday music, but in addition to holiday music, because I happen to love holiday music in a special way. But there are other styles of music, including styles of music that feature the group Kekele. And they're a wonderful Congolese rumba ensemble. Their music in Africa was influenced by the music of Cuba and went back from Cuba to Africa. And then you get this Congolese Cuban-styled rumba, and it's played in an old-fashioned style, but with a little bit of, a contemporary nuance. It's called Tubela.
Bosa na manso maleka e banda kaka na bomwana papa tango to banda kinga na yo na liyo to
mela kwa masumelo kwa biso tubela tubela kwa masumelo kwa biso tubela.
That's Kekele.
Yeah, Kekele, and do you like to dance, Rob? This is certainly...
I don't, but I like dance music a lot. Go figure.
All right. Well, no, this is exactly what this music is designed to do, and that is to inspire dance, a sense of community, a sense of fun, grandma's dancing with the grandkids and all that kind of thing. This is what Congolese rumba is about, and it mirrors Cuban music really quite fashionably.
You know what else is as nice as this time of year? It's not particularly cold outside. Well, maybe a little colder today. But you hear a rumba, and automatically you think of palm trees and swaying things in the wind. It feels like a nice little dose of tropical.
Well, you're very kind to Wisconsin listeners, just to convey that thought. Yes, it does give you that sense of the Caribbean or Cuba or warm places. And that is part of the signature of the music, is to convey this sense of warmth and appeal. And it has some wonderful flavor in that way.
And one thing I love when we start listening to world music, as we do on Higher Ground, is in my brain, sometimes I compartmentalize, like, oh, here's Cuban music, here's Mexican music, here's Congolese music, for example. But as you said, this is Cuban and Caribbean and Congolese. There's this conversation going along, bouncing back and forth all over the world.
Well, they call it fusion. And some of it works, some of it doesn't work. There is a sense of salsa music being blended with Celtic music. I think that actually works.
You brought us some of that last time, and I thought, how's that going to work?
Well,
it did.
In this case, it does. Some styles just don't. You know it fits when you hear it, and it makes you groove a little bit. You want to listen to it again. You want to check out the artist. And so, yes, fusion is really a part of modernity today. People want to get together with styles they've never really played with before, or people want to hear it, and bands make it. And so it's very appealing these days, and I think we'll find it exploring more and more to rural parts of the world where contemporary instruments are used alongside some ancient ones as well.
And we're going to go to Mexico next. What did you bring us from Mexico?
Well, I wish I could bring you Ana Lila Down Sanchez, but I'm sure she's busy performing. But she is a Mexican-American singer-songwriter, and she performs her own compositions, as well as, well, she likes to tap into traditional Mexican music forms and popular music and world music. And here she is, a wonderful artist. I love her contralto voice. She performs a piece called Viborita.
Viborita de la mar.
No me vayas a picar.
Again, if I had the capacity to dance and weren't so awkward, this would be music that would be great to dance to.
Well, it's funny because, once again, this particular piece has both Mexican influences in it and African influences. And people don't often talk about the fact that Mexico has real affinity with the music of Africa. Some of the enslaved Africans ended up in Mexico, and they put their signature on Mexican music. And you can hear that wonderful African rumba beat mixed in with the music as well. Another case of fusion.
Yeah, that's really interesting to me. I don't know if you know this, Jonathan, but my father was from Puebla in Mexico, but I haven't taken the time to explore a lot of Mexican music yet, so it's interesting to hear about these cross currents again going on. Is this a good person to check out, Lila Downs?
I think so. I think she's actually the pivotal traditional artist who puts popular nuances into her music and really creates her own signature artistically. So I think it's a great artist. You know, the thing about world music is try different things, explore. I call it growing your ear, where you want to listen to things that you haven't experienced before. And it's okay. Like Duke Ellington said, there's only two kinds of music, good and bad, and you can decide which one you like. That's kind of the way it goes.
Dr. Jonathan Overby is with us. You know him as the host of Higher Ground. He is sharing some great world music with us. I heard a couple tracks so far. Now, some Slavonic gypsy music you've got for us.
Yeah, gypsy music. Rob, we're going to get you dancing before I leave here today.
You don't want to see it.
Well,
trust me.
I'll tell you what. I know you can feel it for sure, because gypsy music by the group Zingaros, and they're going to do a tune called Tutti Frutti. And the band was formed in the winter of 2004, and they started out using guitar and violin, and then they added an accordion player. And it's really an elaborate fusion of Slavic gypsy music, tango flavor, hot club nuances, and some other contemporary nuances. And in some ways, it's unexplored music, some new horizons for this Argentinian ensemble performing Tutti Frutti. Okay, Tutti Frutti there. I'm assuming that means the same thing in English as it does in this language. I can only hope. You notice something? It has some sort of gypsy Yiddish nuances to the music.
It does.
And those Balkan. And again, here it is that you'll hear music where Traveling minstrels would go from place to place, going from region to region, taking their own signature sound and mixing it with other cultures. And folks are listening to this stuff and saying, aha, here's some of my own tradition in the background of the music, as well as some new flavors. And I think this is what's exciting about world music. I really think that all music fits into the world music category, even classical Eurocentric music. I think it's a new way to define music, and it's much more inclusive in my thinking.
You said this band was from Argentina, did I hear you?
That's right.
And I'm hearing these Balkan scales, but I feel a little bit of a sway there. Yeah.
Well, that's part of the beauty of radio or recorded music or travel or performances, is that these musicians rub shoulders with others of different traditions. And they get their appetite wet and want to try new things, new horizons, so that they become, well, in a word, unique with their own sound. And I think that's quite special and really a wonderful part of music making.
So everything here has been fusion music, as you were talking about. Is this something that's, you get, I assume, you know, hundreds of CDs a year. Are you seeing a lot of fusion now? Is this, the era of globalization in music, too?
I tell you what, it's a mixture of traditional music that stays true to its roots, whether it's modern or ancient. And I'm also seeing a growth in fusion music. I think it's great. I love traditional things because it keeps you grounded in what is the underpinning of how some of the things in modernity came about. So it's a nice time in the world to celebrate music and a great time to reconnect with things of the past. And a lot of the music really celebrates people in a way that's really wonderfully edifying and a chance for folks to learn about each other.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Jonathan Overby is executive producer and host of the WPR Weekend World Music Show, Higher Grounds. You can catch it on Saturday nights.
And hey, we'll put the names of these tracks we've heard up on the Central Time Facebook page so you can find them yourself. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're listening to All I Want for Christmas Is You by Mariah Carey. It's a song that was made popular by the Christmas movie Love Actually.
For better or worse. That movie is one of our next guest's favorite holiday movies. We want to know what your favorite holiday movie is now at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite movies to watch this time of year? What do you think is the best holiday movie of all time? Call in and share your favorites now at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Mike Mayo is with us now. He's a film critic and a novelist, and he's joining us from the studios at WUNC. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much. And it was really terrific to hear that little bit of Mariah Carey there from Love Actually, because I just watched that again a few weeks ago with a big crowd of people, and it was just surprised again at what a real crowd pleaser it is. People just love that movie, and if you haven't seen it in a while, take another look. I promise you will be hugely entertained by it.
Yeah, it's a really good holiday movie, and I have, in recent years, it's my tradition to, while I'm wrapping presents late at night, to watch it. And it's something I look forward to now. I'm surprised how good that holds up, because the first time I saw it, I thought, oh, this is a sweet little movie, but when you watch it, it seems like it gets better and better.
It does, and I think it's the combination of a really nice script, a terrific cast of kind of every British actor who wasn't involved in the Harry Potter movies at the time shows up in it somewhere. And it just has a really terrific bittersweet quality that I think is really important for Christmas movies. They can't be all sweetness and light. There's got to be a little seasoning in there. And to me, that movie just really hits the sweet spot perfectly.
Well, here's a little taste of Love Actually.
Whenever I get gloomy with the state of the world, I think about the arrivals gate at Heathrow Airport. General opinion starting to make out that we live in a world of hatred and greed. But I don't see that. Seems to me that love is everywhere. Often it's not particularly dignified or newsworthy, but it's always there.
Hugh Grant there, I think, as the Prime Minister of England in that movie. Now, there's been a bit of a backlash I've seen online, Mike, as rebelling people against Love Actually, saying it's kind of schmarmy, things like that. I had fun with it. I'm not knocking it. But can you see a point maybe some people not liking the movie so much?
Yeah, I can understand that. There are a couple of sequences in it that don't work as well. This is a big ensemble cast, mm-hmm. like I said, and it's telling about half a dozen or so stories, and some of them are better than others. I'll be the first to admit that. But to me, the parts that work so well that it's easy to forgive the other parts And the Hugh Grant as the prime minister has some terrific moments. And we can't go wrong, or we must mention that Billy Bob Thornton is terrific as the evil American president.
I forgot that he was in that, yeah. Well, you said, Mike, that your holiday movies have to have the bitter and the sweet. Why do they have to have both?
I really think that if they don't have that, it just becomes too cloying. And you really need something a little extra in there to make them human. The perfect example, one that we'll be talking about a bit later, is How the Grinch Stole Christmas, which, when you think about it, is just a retelling of Scrooge, in that you've got the character who starts out as really hating mankind but comes around by the end of it. And if you don't have that kind of transformation in there, for you to have the transformation, you've got to start with the bad guy becoming the good guy.
Well, let's hear about that bad guy.
Then the Grinch thought of something he hadn't before. Maybe Christmas, he thought, doesn't come from a store. Maybe Christmas, perhaps, means a little bit more.
Well, spoiler alert, that one was close to the end of The Grinch. That's one. I mean, obviously, Dr. Seuss's writing doesn't hurt, and the music there makes that one, too.
And the terrific animation by Chuck Jones, famous for all of the Bugs Bunny cartoons, and Boris Karloff as our narrator there. All of that just fits perfectly. And I am not one of these people who hate the Jim Carrey version, because I love the original TV version so much. But I really think it does just hold up so well. And that's why you see it repeated every year many, many times at Christmas, and why I would imagine there are thousands, if not millions, of families out there who own a copy on DVD.
And Mike, when we talked to you earlier, you didn't pull any punches. You told us what your very favorite holiday movie, in this case a Christmas movie, is, and it's A Christmas Story. What do you like about it?
Oh, I remember seeing that during when it first came out, and I was reviewing for a newspaper at the time, and I went to a theater that was virtually empty on a Friday afternoon, no critics screening, anything like that. And then when I realized what it was, and the great Gene Shepherd narration and everything, those I have always loved his stories. It was just this great sense of discovery. I had no idea this was going to be such a terrific movie, because if I'm remembering correctly, it did not come out right at Christmas time. But it just has that the human quality that I was talking about, the kind of rough homemade look to it, and just the great sense of fun all the way through. There's a real good reason why they show that, you know, like 24/7, starting pretty soon now. We'll be seeing it everywhere on television, because it really does just hold up. And I think the casting is perfect. I just love the storytelling, the human quality of it.
And here's a bit of A Christmas Story on the radio to go along with all the TV airings.
No, no, I want an official red under combination. Do you want to check with my leg rifle?
You'll shoot your eye out, kid. Merry Christmas. Ho, ho, ho.
We are talking to Mike Mayo, film critic, about the best holiday movies of all time. You can join in with your favorites, maybe your tradition this time of year, at 800-642-1234. Let's go to a caller. We'll get back to some of Mike's picks in a minute. Tracy is on the line in Green Bay. Tracy, hi.
Hi. I have sort of an unconventional favorite holiday movie, although it does have some of the bitter and some of the sweet. More recent, The Ref, with Dennis Leary and Kevin Spacey. It just, for whatever reason, it gets me in the holiday mood. It's all about kind of the breakdown of the modern American family and how the Christmas spirit and a little bit of negativity thrown in kind of gets everybody back together.
Tracy, thanks a lot for that call. So, Mike, and she's not alone. Not everybody watches a Christmas movie necessarily around the holidays. They'll take something that happens during Christmas time, or maybe something like Star Wars, where they show a marathon around Christmas time. Are there any that you have in that category, Mike?
Well, The Ref is not the first movie that would have come to my mind, but I guess it is a Christmas movie. And, you know, it's the heartwarming tale of a home invasion with Dennis Leary and Kevin Spacey and Judy Davis. And they're this married couple that are squabbling, and he has, I can't remember, he's a thief who's gotten into their home, and I'm not sure the exact plot developments there, but he's sort of the referee as they're sorting out their marriage. It's bleak, it's dark, but it does have that redemption in it that we're talking about. So, yeah, that's certainly a holiday movie that deserves consideration. I don't think it's one I'm going to dash right back home tonight and watch again.
Well, maybe you can settle another score for us. The debate about the movie Die Hard. Mm-hmm. Is it a Christmas movie or is it not? We were talking to our state capitol reporter, told him we were going to be talking to you, Mike, and asked him for his favorite movies. I can't remember he said It's a Wonderful Life, mm-hmm. and then he said, and Die Hard. So yeah. is that a Christmas movie?
Well, it has to be. I mean, it's set at Christmas. Christmas is very important to the plot. And there's a thing going around the internet now that you just see everywhere. And I have to agree with it, as cliched as it is. It's not Christmas until Hans Gruber falls off the Nakatomi building. And that's...
Well, getting back to the bitter and sweet side of things, here's a clip from a Christmas movie, a holiday movie that centers around an attempted suicide.
Look, Daddy, teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
That's right. That's right. Atta boy, Clarence.
So there's a sweet moment in It's a Wonderful Life, but a lot of the movie is pretty dark, actually.
Very dark. And it's one of those movies that I like so much because it does not resolve all of the conflicts that it's brought up. The evil guy whose name escapes me right now still has the money at the Potter has the money at the end of it. And then there's so much more going on in that movie, too, the way it really shows the whole course of the relationship between Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed. Yes, it has the sappy moments like we just heard, but there's a lot more going on in that movie. And if you haven't seen that in a long time, take another look. I think you will be surprised at what a good movie it is, what a solidly constructed movie it is in terms of the storytelling.
We just rewatched that one recently, and I was struck by how, you know, the main character, George Bailey, he's kind of a loose cannon in the movie. He is edgy. Was this movie edgy for its time, do you think?
It was, and it was also very unsuccessful when it was first released. People thought, you know, oh my gosh, this is Capra doing what he's always done, and it took a long time for that movie to become beloved.
We're talking to film critic Mike Mayo about his favorite holiday movies and asking for your favorites, too, at 800-642-1234. What do you think is the best Christmas movie ever made? And what movie do you always watch this time of year, whether thematically it has anything to do with Christmas or not? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're picking up our discussion now about the best holiday movies with film critic Mike Mayo.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you going to settle in and watch over the holidays? What's the best holiday movie, holiday themed, or one that you just like to see this time of year? Do you have a tradition with your friends or family? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go back to our callers now. Lynn is with us in Racine. Lynn, hi.
Good afternoon.
What do you got for us, Lynn?
Well, of course, It's a Wonderful Life. Mm-hmm. And I actually had a friend who would never watch it all the way through because she said it was so depressing. She never got to the end. Once she got to the end, then she liked the movie. But anyway, one of my favorites is The Best Christmas Pageant Ever. It was a TV special with Loretta Swit, and I really enjoyed that, and I do look forward to seeing it. I have it, so I put it in myself.
Lynn, thanks. I feel like I dimly remember seeing that, or somebody put it on as a school play, or I read it.
Yeah, I have a very dim memory, too. I know the book, you know,
maybe that's
my kids like, but I didn't know there was a TV adaptation.
Mike, you got anything for us?
This always happens when I'm on with you guys. Somebody's going to bring up something that I do not know at all, and Lynn got me here.
All right,
it's an adaptation of a popular play we're hearing from our board operator, Michelle, our technical director here. She knows these things.
I know it's a book, though.
Yeah,
Is there a book and a play? All right, someone needs to solve this for us.
And a TV thing.
Yeah, let us know on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us.
At Central Time WPR.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, we'll get back to our callers with Tiffany in Racine. Tiffany, hi.
Hi.
What movie did you want to bring up?
I don't know that it's really a Christmas movie, but I watch The Sound of Music every year right around this time.
Okay, I mean that's it's got some bitterness, obviously Nazi takeover. It's got some sweet, although a lot of the happy music. Mike, is that one that you think people might take as a holiday movie?
Sure, and so much of this depends on our own personal reaction to things when we see the circumstances under which we first see them and things like that. I can remember years ago, circumstances forced me on Christmas to be by myself, and I watched the movie Major League on TV. and since then, it just occupies a warm spot in my heart. It has nothing to do with Christmas, but because I saw it when I was alone in this cheap motel, I will always think of it that way. And so, you know, it belongs under my own Christmas list, I suppose.
Nice. And that's a whole other categories of music, I guess. It's something that carries that warm, fuzzy aura of the holidays that just sort of attaches itself to the movies we watch then.
And I think that's more important than we really realize in our reaction to movies. It has nothing to do with the quality of the movie, but it's just our own personal circumstances at the time we first experience it.
Well, thanks a lot for the call, Tiffany. And next we're going to go to Anita in Lindenhurst, Illinois. Anita, hi.
Hi. My favorite Christmas movie, and apparently many others since I have to stand in line for like a month at the library to get my copy, is Home for the Holidays with Robert Downey Jr., Charles Durning, and Bancroft, and two actresses that are well known that are not in my mind at this moment.
All right, thank you for that, Anita. She says Home for the Holidays with Robert Downey Jr. and Bancroft and some other people in the movie. Mike, tell us about that one.
I know I have seen that movie, and I can remember absolutely nothing about it right now. Okay, you've gotten me. I'm 2 for 4 so far here with being stumped by the listeners.
Well, you're one up on me, you guys, because I thought Home for the Holidays, that's going to be some like 1940s movie, distant golden era sort of thing. No, Robert Downey Jr. was not around then. All right. Well, thank you so much for the suggestion, Anita. Glad you got your copy. We'll go next to Frank with us in Madison. Frank, hi.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call. One of my favorite movies is going to be shown this Saturday night at 7 o'clock on Turner Classic Movies, The Shop Around the Corner. James Stewart, Margaret Sullivan, Frank Morgan, whole bunch of, you know, good supporting actors. It's basically... Margaret Sullivan and James Stewart were like this duo that were famous in the 30s, like Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan were, and Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan remade this as You've Got Mail years later. Also, Judy Garland and Van Heflin remade it as In the Good Old Summertime, and I think there was another remake that I forget right now, but it's basically two co-workers in a little store in Budapest who don't realize it, but they are pen pals, and they sort of get on each other's nerves, in fact, sort of hate each other as co-workers, but they're great pen pals. And so anyway, it goes on like that.
And this is one you like to watch around Christmas, Frank, or does key Christmas scene?
Well, anytime I like to watch it. But, you know, it ends with the sale at the store on Christmas Eve and them, you know, and basically the people in the store who are divided at first in some ways, there are tensions in that, but those are resolved by Christmas Eve, and then they have a great sale of stuff on Christmas Eve, so everybody's happy. and then finally the two people realize that they are in love with each other.
Whoa, spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Frank, thank you so much for sharing that. So Jimmy Stewart, the king of the holidays a little bit there, Mike.
Yeah, and I can add nothing to what Frank said, because he got all of the other versions of it that have been made. You can just tell when you've got a story like this that, you know, really works with the characters and the funky situation of the, you know, mistaken identities, then, you know, you can retell it so many times, and if you do it right, it's popular every time. And Jimmy Stewart was the recipient of really good scripts like that in a lot of different categories. I'm thinking also of the Philadelphia Story. These kinds of things just seem to come to him.
And Mike, a lot of people excited about another holiday movie coming out, and it's nothing we've talked about today, but it's something everyone is talking about. Name that movie.
Star Wars: The Force Awakens, and I am here to tell everybody that it is every bit as good as you'd hoped it would be. I went to see it worried that it wasn't going to be what I'd wanted it to be, and was won over completely. The two young people in it, Daisy Ripley and John Boyega, have just become major stars. And all of our listeners, do not listen to or read any reviews of it. There are a lot of really important things that you don't want to know anything about. To appreciate this movie, go to see it as cold as you can. And it doesn't matter whether you see it in 2D or 3D. I saw the 2D version. It's just fine. But you want to go into it not knowing anything about it. And I promise you, if you're a Star Wars fan, you will enjoy it.
Fantastic. Well, I want to leave us, since we got just a moment or so left, with another one of your favorites. Let's get a listen to a bit of Scrooged with Bill Murray.
Grace, who is that guy?
Elliot Loudermilk.
Okay. Call security. Have them change his locks, clean out his desk, and toss him out of the building.
Oh, he's fired? But it's Christmas.
Thank you. Call accounting. Stop his bonus.
Bill Murray in the Ebenezer Scrooge role. I think this is a lot of fun. This is one I enjoy going back to. This is one of your favorites, Mike?
Oh, yeah. I really loved it. And the character he's talking about there is played by Bobcat Goldthwait, of all people. Uh-huh. And he's being fired for having told the truth about the Christmas specials that the Bill Murray character wants to run on his TV network, which opens with a bunch of terrorists attacking the North Pole and Santa Claus. And
the Knights of Reindeer
Claus
Blood.
Arming himself. It's really funny, and I really love the redemption that Murray finds at the end of that movie. He has, I think, one of his really great Bill Murray speeches at the end, talking about the real meaning of Christmas. And it's worth watching again for that, if nothing else. But the whole movie is really a lot of fun. And it's one that you see on sale. There are DVDs of it everywhere, and I'm sure it'll be showing up on a lot of broadcast TV this time of year, too.
And, Mike, it's always a lot of fun to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
That's film critic and novelist Mike Mayo with us to talk about the best holiday movies of all time. His latest books, latest novel, Jimmy and Faye, a latest in a series, is coming out early next year. Still time, by the way, for you to share your favorite holiday movie, your favorite holiday movie traditions, too. You can do that over at the Central Time Facebook page.